Today the liturgy gives us two very well-known stories. We start reading from the book of Jonah, and I think everyone knows the story of Jonah and being swallowed up and by the great fish and his preaching to the Ninevites. And then in the Gospel, one of the best known of the parables, that is the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's interesting that these two readings, which each one of them is great, but putting them together gives us quite a bit to ponder. It's interesting that these readings come to us right after what we heard yesterday about the wicked tenants in the vineyard who kept the harvest for themselves and were violent against those who came to collect from them. You could say that Jonah acts like a wicked tenant, and you could say that the priest and the Levite in this parable act like wicked tenants. In fact, the priest and the Levite, since they're responsible for the vineyard, responsible for the people of God, they really are acting very much like the wicked tenants in yesterday's parable. Let's take a look at these. Now, we'll be reading from Jonah for 3 days, so this is only the beginning. It's quite a fascinating little story. It has some of the characteristics of a fable. One of the striking things about it is that Jonah is the only bad guy in the whole story. Everyone else in the story of Jonah is obedient to God and as best they can be, even the fish and the animals, the pagans. But Jonah is the one who refuses to do the will of God. Sometimes he's referred to as the reluctant prophet. It's kind of a kindly way of saying it. He's actually a disobedient prophet. He's sent by the Lord to go to Nineveh. He deliberately goes the opposite direction. So it's exactly the opposite of the will of God. Now this story has this quality that maybe in modern lingo you would say is in your face. It's in your face. It's deliberately showing the contrast between Jonah, who is a Jew, and the pagans, who are much more responsive and have much deeper religious spirit. As if it's to show to the Jews, you're not responding to the grace you have. Remember the story or the Gospel we had a couple of days ago where Jesus was chastising the Jewish towns where he had been doing his ministry, and he said if Tyre and Sidon had seen what you see, they would have converted. You could almost hear the same thing. If Nineveh heard this, and they converted, what about you? Now, we haven't gotten to Nineveh yet, because that comes up, I think, in tomorrow's reading. But here, it's Jonah going to Tarshish, which is to the west, when God sent him to the east, to Nineveh. And he gets on a ship with these sailors who are not Jews. And then this storm comes up. Now the storm is a direct response to his disobedience. It's God interfering with Jonah's disobedience, as if God himself, he's not forcing Jonah to go to Nineveh, but he's going to make it difficult for him to go away. And that entangles these sailors in Jonah's disobedience. And so they naturally start praying to their gods and making sacrifice. Jonah, in the meantime, goes to sleep. You see the contrast? Even these pagans who don't even know God, they know that when you're in trouble, you cry out to God. Whereas Jonah, who is causing the trouble, is asleep. Contrast. What a dead religious spirit Jonah has. And then they find out Jonah is the cast lots, Jonah is the reason, and they ask him, you know, what is this? And they find out that he is going away, he's fleeing from the Lord. And the response of the sailors is, how could you do such a thing? How could you say no to God? Like we would say to the wicked tenants in yesterday's parable, how could you do such a thing? Where could you get into your mind that you have the right to take for yourself something that belongs to God? Where do you have the right to say no to God? One of the things that comes out here is the quality of natural religion. You say these pagan sailors, they don't know God, but they know that you don't say no to the gods. You don't arrogantly oppose the gods. You have to submit to them. So they're probably thinking the god of the sea or the god of the wind or the god of something or other that is causing the problem. So they're trying to placate these gods. Maybe this comes to mind because today's saints were sent to pagan France. This is way back in the 3rd century. This is way back in the before Christianity was even a legal religion. And Saint Denis and his companions were sent to what was known as Gaul then, we call it France. And they were sent to what we know as Paris, and they were preaching the gospel there. No, it's true, they got martyred for it, they got beheaded. But the roots of the gospel actually did penetrate the pagan cultures, because pagans generally have a sense that you should submit to God. You should submit to God, that you don't have the right to oppose the gods. This is one of the reasons why in our times the explosion of Christianity is taking place in Africa, because Africa is still in its first evangelization wave. Christianity is winning over people who had pagan or animistic belief systems. It's extraordinary how quickly the gospel is spreading in different parts of Africa. Whereas in Europe, which was profoundly Christian, France was the daughter of the church. France was a very Catholic country. That now is seen as a post-Christian mission territory. And it's much, much harder to proclaim the gospel to people who think that it's old-fashioned and no longer necessary. Whereas pagan people who don't know, and who know that you should submit to God because that's just normal, they're more open to being evangelized. Where people who have come to the point of saying, no gods are going to tell me what to do. That's the modern or postmodern idea. No gods. First of all, they don't exist. And secondly, even if they did exist, they have no right to tell me what to do. So it's very hard to convert people like that, because they don't have the humility to submit to anybody. They themselves become gods. So anyway, I'm mentioning this because of Saint Denis, and he's the first bishop of Paris, but also because Jonah is taking this idea, God can't tell me what to do. I don't have to do what he says. Kind of a modern problem. Anyway, we know what happens. He does at least honestly say, I'm fleeing from the Lord. They try their best, the sailors try their best to save him. They can't do it. They finally say, Lord, you know, don't hold this against us. But he told us to throw him off the ship. He's the one who said it, and you know, don't hold it against us. And they throw him off the ship, and the sea calms down. And then notice what happens to the sailors. They are struck with great fear of the Lord, and they offer sacrifice and make vows to him. They're converted instantly. Jonah ends up in the belly of the whale, or the large fish, as it's described here, 3 days and 3 nights. And this is an image that Jesus uses for himself. Jonah, 3 days and 3 nights in the whale. Jesus will be 3 days and 3 nights in the earth, in the depths of the earth. And then Jonah comes out. This is the end of this reading. He's spewed out onto the shore, and Jesus will come up out of the tomb. Kind of a funny thing that Jesus chooses the worst, the most reluctant of the prophets, the worst example of the prophets, as an image for himself and for the resurrection. But it's as if to say, you have something much greater than Jonah here. Okay, we'll continue this story tomorrow and Wednesday. Let's take a look at this passage about the Good Samaritan. Remember, the question that the scholar of the law asked was, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Who am I supposed to love? And you would think that the answer would be, well, love this person and this person and this person. Expand your idea of who to love. But when Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, and we know the parable, that the man gets beaten up, he's in desperate need, the priest and the Levite deliberately ignore that need, justifying themselves somehow. And the good guy in the parable is the hated Samaritan. He turns the bad guy into the good guy. And then, I won't go into all the details, but you know, Jesus at the end asks the question, which of these three was neighbor to the robber's victim? You see how he turns it around? The scholar asked, who is my neighbor? And Jesus turns around and says, well, who are you? Who are you to be the neighbor to? You know, in other words, be the neighbor. Don't be asking who's my neighbor. Everybody's your neighbor. But who are you sent to help? Who is the neighbor? Who was neighbor to the victim? We think the victim is the neighbor. No, the Samaritan is the neighbor. And this puts it back on ourselves. Well, it's not just that we're looking at other people. We ourselves are called to be good to one another, to do good to those in need, especially those who are right in front of us. If we want to use the image of being workers in the vineyard, when we're sent into the vineyard, we're sent to the people who God puts before us today. This Samaritan was not expecting to find a victim on the road, but there he was. So that was the vineyard into which he had been sent to do his work. Whereas the priest and the Levite, they were sent to the same vineyard and they didn't do the work. Scandal. The scandal of people who say that they are going to do the will of God and they don't do it. That was last week. No. Yes, I will go into the vineyard and work, but I don't actually do it. Or I will look like I'm working, but in fact, I'm just taking care of myself. Or I work, but I keep the harvest for myself. Scandal. So here we are. This is the negative example of Jonah, the positive example of the pagan sailors. The negative example of the priest and the Levite, the positive example of the Samaritan. Now, one last thing about this parable, since it's an illustration of love, love of God and love of neighbor, the fathers of the church sometimes point out that this parable is also a kind of allegory of the whole redemption. The victim represents all of us. We're all brutalized by sin. We're left damaged by sin. We're on death's door because of sin. Sin leads to death. The law didn't save us. And the prophets didn't save us. The priest and the Levite didn't save us. Who comes along to save us? Who's the Good Samaritan? Jesus. Jesus identifies himself as... This is the shocker again, because the Samaritans, remember, were the enemies of the Jews. He identifies himself as a Good Samaritan. In other words, someone who is going to go out of his way to take care of the victim. And this is Jesus. Not just pouring out oil and wine, but pouring out his blood for the healing of our wounds. And not just paying with two silver coins, but paying with his life. Saying, I'm going to pay enough to make sure this person recovers, the human family recovers, and more than enough. I'm going to pay as much as it possibly takes, as much as it is needed to make sure this victim can recover. That's the image of the Good Samaritan. That's what Jesus is, and he's the model that he sets before us to follow. Where can we get love like that? Where can we get love that makes it possible for us to go beyond our self-protection and our self-interest? Well, we have to get it from him. This is what the martyrs show us, like St. Denis and his companions. That it's not just that they're naturally strong people, or they're just heroic people. They know that they're loved by Jesus Christ. They know that they have already been saved from being beaten up, and so they have this abundance to share with others, and that's us. We have been We are the victims who have been rescued, and so we have plenty to offer to one another. Let us take then this instruction on being the neighbor to those around us.